This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
And the Buddhists would say, even though they use the deities, that they're empty. And that right. The deity and the perceiver of the deity co-arise in an interesting way. So are you a theist or a non-theist, would you say?
I definitely love God. And okay. That's my anything. That's my stance. That's the party. And everything that I'm trying to do is hopefully bringing me a more of awareness to be able to love God. And by loving God, I mean by loving the self and loving everything that you come into contact and being able to see the divine in all things through undifferentiated light. Now, when you get into undifferentiated light, then you get into no right or wrong. Now you're into almost a non-theistic thing, you know? So you're into consciousness. And that, to me, that's what Shiva, the true meaning of Shiva, is the consciousness of infinite goodness.
The consciousness of infinite goodness. The consciousness of infinite goodness. Wherever you are listening right now in time and space, I encourage you to take a moment, touch your heart, straighten your back, take a nice deep breath, and just say that to yourself or out loud a couple times. The consciousness of infinite goodness. Welcome, friends. Welcome to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nickturn on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael, your host and monologist. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And I am particularly excited to share this conversation with you with David and our guest, tattoo artist, painter, business proprietor, and Dharma practitioner, Robert Ryan. Robert is an amazing artist who really embodies our primary themes of creativity, spirituality, and right livelihood. Creatively, Robert is a highly regarded tattoo artist who's created a distinct and sought-after style merging the foundations of American tattooing with the style of Indian Kaligat painting, an approach to deity depictions done very quickly with simple lines and bold iconic images practiced by artists outside of the Kali Temple in Calcutta. Robert is also a painter who has recently released a beautiful book entitled Deity, featuring many incredible paintings of Hindu deities with Dharma commentaries. You can acquire a copy of Deity, which is a beautifully bound and produced tome, at Raking Light Projects. An earlier book of Robert's work, The Inborn Absolute, is currently reissued and available at Featherproof Publishers. For a quick sampling of Robert's work, head over to his Instagram, which is full of incredible spiritual tattoos and paintings, at RobertRyan323. Spiritually, Robert is also a devout practitioner of Sanatana Dharma and practices in the Tantric lineage. You don't often hear the word God, as we did in the intro on a podcast based in Buddha Dharma, so this is a particularly clarifying conversation on the unfolding of Buddhist and Hindu Tantra. And in terms of making a buck, Robert is also a co-owner of Electric Tattoo in Asbury Park, New Jersey, where you can get adorned by him by appointment or try and get a walk-in spot on Saturdays. More info at www.electrictattoonewjersey.com. Okay, that's probably enough table setting, so let's get to the main course. And now we present to you episode number 30 of the CSM podcast, Deity with Robert Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. We have a special guest, Robert Ryan, with us today. Robert is a renowned tattoo artist, and in particular, he often creates tattoo art that's based on Hindu deities. So that's a very unique and original perspective. And he just actually tattooed our podkick, Michael Kammers, which is how we were introduced. So first of all, welcome, Robert, and thank you for coming along here.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be here. I'm a big fan of the show and of your writings, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Great. And we'll just kind of allow, those are your dogs from India, did you say?
Yeah, they're feral dogs from India that I adopted a few years ago, and they still, you can take the dog from India, but you can't take the India from the dog sometimes.
Did you rescue them? Were they street dogs?
Not first. They were street dogs. I didn't personally bring them home, but I've adopted them through a rescue program of a woman that lives here in New Jersey who used to work for, I think she worked for the Indian consulate at some time. So she has a lot of connections there, and she kind of flies dogs out of India to here because they just get hit by cars there all the time.
You're a sweetheart. It's so obvious. And on behalf of those two beings, thank you so much for rescuing us. You know, that's really, really noble. When I was introduced to your work by Michael Kammers, what tattoo did you give him? I haven't seen it yet.
I gave him the Sword of Manjushri.
Manjushri.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. And it's being accompanied with a skull that's based off the Tanka style painting in Tibet. So it's the sword through the skull with the effulgence behind the skull is the rainbow colors.
Beautiful. I can't wait to see it. You know, we don't get to see each other these days so much. Michael and I used to hang out quite a bit in person. But I think now that we're talking about it, I don't think I've physically seen him since the pandemic started.
It's amazing that we have this, like, these dual lifestyles now, you know, because we don't see our friends and loved ones like we used to, but everyone's still living and going through doing amazing things, quite honestly, in the confines of their own home or in small groups of people. I don't think it's stifled creativity at all. I think it's actually accelerated a lot of creativity this pandemic. Mm.
Well, you don't have a virtual version of your business, do you? There's no such thing, right?
No, not at all. And that because of that reason, I was considered an essential worker and I was able to go back to work pretty early. You know, the first thing I thought once the shutdown happened, I was like, I'm never going to be able to do this again. You know, when am I going to be able to touch someone again physically and tattoo them, you know? Oh. So I just started painting right away as much as I could to kind of stockpile paintings in case that I was going to have to live off that for a long time. But luckily they let us back to work pretty early on. I think we were only out of work for about 3 months.
And is your workload back to full now?
It fluctuates now with the amount of the way the pandemic goes. You know, when the numbers were down, we kind of opened up to more people, kind of like what restaurants do. And then when it got heavy again, we had to like limit it to like no guests with the person that's getting tattooed. And there's like a whole screening process, you know, with taking people's temperature. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it with this, the new pandemic regulations.
Wow. And you're in Asbury Park, New Jersey, right? Famous place.
I am. Home of the boss.
Yeah, man. That's like Bruce Springsteen has probably immortalized that place. But before that, for people like me who grew up in New York, it was already famous.
Yeah. I think it became pretty happening around the 20s and 30s and stayed popular up until the early 80s, and then it took a hard hit. Mm-hmm. And it rebuilt itself, or people rebuilt it, or it rebuilt itself, however you choose to believe. In about 2000 it started, and then now by about 2012 it became back into full swing.
And it's on the boardwalk there, isn't it? Right on the ocean?
Coastal New Jersey. Yeah, we're right. I'm about a mile from the ocean right now.
Yeah. Is that water swimmable these days, or?
No, it's cold. I mean, as far as cleanliness, yes, but the temperature is freezing now.
But in the summer, you can go down the boardwalk and jump in the ocean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. It's amazing.
I thought it'd be interesting to just tune in a little bit to, there's two parts to your artwork. One is it's extremely beautiful and articulated. And, if you didn't know the source code of it, which is a lot of it is based on Hindu deities, it would be interesting in and of itself. But are you yourself a practicing, would you call yourself Hindu? Is that your spiritual practice?
Yeah. For all intents and purposes, it would be considered Hinduism. It's Sanatana Dharma, where the lineage that I follow is actually a Kalu Tantric practice of Shiva and Shakti worship. I'm initiated through a guru, and I've been with for about 10 years. And I consider myself a devotee.
Yeah. So, if for those out there who might not be as familiar, if there were a couple of core tenets or premises to your tradition, what would they be?
It's use of using ritual and symbolism to express not only the inward journey but also the outward journey. Worship of Shiva and Devi, the goddess, through the means of Purusha and Prakriti, like consciousness and nature. Mm-hmm. And it's balancing those two things with the three, just like the show. I was thinking the name of your mm-hmm. show is the triangle. The three things that you need to be on the spiritual path, because you need a goal, you need the means to do it, and then you gain the liberation.
It's so interesting to these days, all the different traditions, the tributaries stream so together in the West. There's so much access to you can look up like all kinds of source code and secret rituals and inner teachings. And you just go, if you go up like on Google and look for Dzogchen or something like that, it'll give you sort of core instructions and things like that. So I have become interested in what I call the United Nations of spirituality. Sure. I taught a lot of Kripalu and Omega and places like that. I'm a Buddhist teacher, but I'm also the guitar player and record producer for Krishna Das. So there was a guy named Shamdas. I don't know if you ever bumped into Sham, mm-hmm. who was a Western, bhakti and kirtanwala, and he died in a motorcycle accident in India. But he was a great and very very learned actually guy, and he used to call me the Shambhalawala. That was his nickname. So I like to be able to work through with people to get down to the core messaging, the seed syllable, the essence of what the teaching might be. And I don't make the leap saying, oh, it's all the same, it's all one, because we don't know that until we really explore it a little bit more. But so you represent you said there's a trilogy, a trinity, a three-headed godhead, if you will, which was Brahma, right? Vishnu?
And Shiva.
And yeah. Shiva. So what do they represent, just for people who are not familiar?
Brahma, the creator, represents the creative capacity in each one of us. Vishnu, the sustainer, represents the sustaining force that keeps us living and moving and motivating. And Shiva, the dissolver, represents the energy that ends things in our lives so we can create anew, whether it be our actual life of dying and taking a new birth or going to a loka or becoming liberated or whatever you might believe, or just ending something that isn't necessary in your life so you can focus on something that is more important. So it's that aspect.
So Shiva, as the way you just described it, is a destroyer. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what you just described sounds like a creator, because it's creating new space.
Exactly, because he's in perfect balance with the other two, you know. So, and he holds the trident, you know, it is a trident, the Trimurti, the three gods. He holds the trident, the Trishul, and that represents the three gunas, which is the waking, dreaming, sleeping states that we're in every moment of our lives, you know. So like it's the balance of the three, and it's not linear or anything like that. So to have a beginning, you have to have an end, and you have to have a middle too. So
right.
So
it really has the quality of beginning, middle, and end. Like good drama. All good drama has that, right?
Of course. Right. There's those dogs again.
Yeah. Well, we could look at them as just more phenomena arising for our podcast listeners. I don't think we have to worry about it.
It's so funny when you said that, because when they had their big outburst before we started, I was like, well, this is just going to be part of our sadhana.
It is. And yes, that shifted, you know, there's a Buddhist Lojong slogan that says, change your attitude and relax as it is. I don't know if you ever heard that one, but it's really
great.
Strong advice. You have a book out, which you were kind enough to send to me, and I'm going to just hold it up for so folks can see it. And it's only been out for 3 months, called Deity by Robert Ryan. And just to, you know, some people will be listening on audio only, but this, if you are looking at the YouTube version of our podcast, this is sort of a sample of the style of art. So maybe you could say something a little bit about the book and what you were trying to communicate with the book.
Yeah, so the book took me about 2 years to make. Even to when I started talking about doing it, it might have been about 4 years ago, but it took 4 years to come into fruition. But it took me about 2 years to do all the paintings and the writing that accompanies the paintings. And my goal for the book was to show people a way of viewing these deities as a aspect of their own selves, mm-hmm. almost as a mirror, so that they would be able to see themselves in maybe a picture of Ganesh, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe not see themselves so much, or just see aspects of their lives in these deities. Mm-hmm. And I tried to create just a portal to each one where someone could bring their own thoughts towards that thing. Because I was being asked a lot when I was tattooing people, are there any books for this kind of stuff? And there are. There's great books about it. But there's not many that compile many of them in that way. You know, I can only think of maybe two or three. And there's not a lot of explanation in those books. So I wanted to try to give Westerners explanation, kind of cursory descriptions of the deities and how they might be able to reflect in people's lives.
How great. And nicely articulated.
Thanks.
Very clear.
I've had a long time to think about.
Yeah. Well, that some people have forever to think about stuff. Doesn't mean they can articulate it either. But this is. Is there a digital version of this book? It's hard to imagine a little bit. But is there?
There's not. I really wanted to make something like, I love albums. You know.
Yeah.
And I haven't been able to make albums in a long time. So I wanted to make something in the same realm that can be really felt and experienced, you know? Yeah.
And so what would be the easiest way for somebody to get a copy if they wanted to? Would it be on Amazon?
It's not on Amazon. I do have a book that will be on Amazon. It's a book that went out of print that's coming back in a soft cover version, which is called The Inborn Absolute. This book, Deity, is through a company called Raking Light Projects. And their website is rakinglightprojects.com. And if you go to my Instagram, you can find links to the book right there on my little homepage or whatever.
Yeah. And we'll have it. We'll put it into the liner notes on the podcast too, so people can find it. Because I think you don't see that many things these days that are analog. And you know, in that realm of like, you know, this is a book that you really, it's big and you want to touch it and look at it and kind of live in it for a little bit. And it really does bring the deities to life. And then you have commentary about them. So I think, for example, my partner, Monica, and I were just talking about Tripura Sundari just last week, which she has a special connection with. You know, Monica teaches tantra and transformational practices for women. She's a lot of time in Thailand doing that. The beautiful, youthful goddess of the three worlds, the golden glowing queen of the Sri Yantra, expression of spiritual discipline and devotion, the cause of health and the aspect of calm. So,
she's my favorite. I mean, that's right now, because we're on day 7 of Navaratri, spring Navaratri.
Okay.
We're chanting the Lalita Sahasranam every morning, a guru with a group of us in Zoom. And Tripura Sundari is the one. She hooked me into it. You know, she's the one that holds me in this. I love her so much. Aspect of the goddess.
We were just talking about her last week. There's a lot of, there's something we call tendril in the Buddhist tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition. You know the word?
Yes. Yeah. I think I might've heard you talk about it before. I think I know it from your discussions, but I love that concept of it.
Yeah. I mean, people use synchronicity, but it's really auspicious coincidence. And it's also the same word. It's just the way that a chain of causation arises anyhow, because we think it's random, but it's, you know, everything has cause and conditions and then comes out of that. Unless it doesn't, you know, which is a different kind of aspect of reality that there aren't, you know, the non-causal aspect of it. So it seems to me from hanging out with Ram Dass and KD and all those folks for decades now that when you approach the non-causal level, it's described differently, but I can't imagine people are talking about two different things at that point because it's beyond conceptual mind. So right. Now you say to somebody beyond conceptual mind, they go beyond conceptual mind. You know, it's just like, how do I put that together? But there's some kind of capacity to experience the world in a really direct way that does go beyond the narrative and the historical quality. And so, you know, like Ram Dass towards the end of his life, I don't know if you saw him do this, but he would go, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. And that's sort of pointing towards that space. You know, Buddhists sometimes point that space out kind of fairly sharply, maybe with a little bit of a stun gun kind of approach to, because the conceptual mind will keep trying to wrap itself around it and can't get there. But when you drop, you know, all the baggage, you know, all the formulation and just experience the world directly, it seems like many of the traditions have a potentially similar route in that experience. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I think it's just being able to see the world through the heart and not through the mind so much, you know, by bridling the mind through the technique of paying attention to your breath or meditation or chanting or awareness in your actions, by narrowing your mind to that kind of focus and attentiveness, the heart gets to do more of the viewing. And then and that's when you're really truly experiencing things. And that's when synchronicities become a lot more common. You've been having these synchronicities your entire life. You just weren't aware of them because you're talking yourself out of this stuff all the time through your drama in your mind.
good advice out there. Of course, the rituals of these different traditions seem to, in my experience, appeal to different people, not exactly by personality, but by, you know, sort of just how they put their world together. Like, for example, Zen, you take the Zen tradition, it's very sparse, you know, there's not a huge amount of imagery. You're kind of simplifying, reducing, almost in a kind of deliberate way to not shut down the sense perceptions, but just elegantize and simplify them. Whereas, for example, when we have these, you know, we've had these gatherings in Maui for the last 10 years, twice a year with Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and various Buddhist teachers. There's always a really kind of, and the yoga teachers, and it's on the beach and people are hanging out, and there's a Tai Chi teacher, you know, just sort of an eclectic gathering. But the different rituals that people are attracted to seem to mirror something about their persona, their personality. So the thing that's interesting in your, about your book, and I'm going to recommend to people to check it out, is, sorry there. I don't know why this is ringing. Excuse me. So, you know, some people are very drawn to, for example, the Hindu deities. They just, they want it tattooed on their body, for example.
Yeah.
Okay. Or they see that symbolism, and they're completely magnetized to it immediately. And I've noticed it's almost like somebody going into, you know, those food fairs, and there's an Italian thing and a, you know, Japanese, people just sort of gravitate towards their thing. And then they find like-minded people there. They usually find teachers that they can connect with and relate to. But what's interesting about those gatherings in Maui, you know, is that we have clearly the bhaktis, you know, are kind of the hosts, you know, the Maharaji, you know, the Neem Karoli Baba gang is hosting the party. And one time I just said to Ram Dass, I said, you throw a really good party. Because it's very, you know, a lot of their culture is based on feeding people, taking care of people, just being a good host. And, you know, so then you have the Buddhists from the sort of Theravadan and Mahayana traditions. You know, you might have insight meditation or a Zen a teacher. And then you have the Tantric Buddhists, like myself, who's just, I'm there as a guitar player most of the time, and or Robert Thurman or somebody like that. And what I found over the years is I had a kinship with the Theravadan and Mahayana Buddhists, because we emphasize discernment and kind of clarity of mind. That seems to be like the on-ramp for a lot of people into that tradition. And but the devotion element is not really there. You don't advocate devotion in the Buddhist world and surrender until you're really into tantric style of teaching. Even in the Mahayana, the teachers considered to be a spiritual friend, Kalyana Mitra. Right? But when you do Tantra in Buddhism, there's a guru, you know, and it's like in the West, it's gotten really tangled up because it's not part of our innate culture. And then the bhaktis and the Hindus, it's all guru. It's all Tantra, actually. And there's not much of a Hinayana or Mahayana level to it. It's just you dive right into the deep end of the pool. So I found myself kinship with the Hindu Tantrikas, you know, on that front, and then kinship with the Buddhists as far as the kind of mindfulness and awareness type of style of practice is going. You follow what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
Really, Buddhism, Tantric Buddhism, really derived from Hinduism. It's just clear as a bell, you know.
100%. And you know, the meaning of Tantra itself is to weave. You know, so you're weaving all these things together to make. You know, you're using everything you got, and it's because you're not so much seeing the world as an illusion. Your mind is the illusion. Everything that's happening to you is real and an essence of the divine. You're seeing the divine in all things, and that's Tantra, you know. So
wait, I want to jump in there, because you just said something really interesting that I want to, before the divine element, which is another kind of leap. You said it's not the world that's the illusion, it's the mind that's the illusion.
Yeah, tell someone who got hit by a truck that wasn't an illusion, you know. But what got you hit by the truck might be the illusion that you can just walk around in the world like nothing, you know, like that nothing is by the grace of the divine, and I am the creator of all these things, and I am the doer, you know. That's where the illusion is, you know. The illusion falls in our thoughts, and I think our thoughts are the things that need to be overcome in this world, not so much these external demons that everyone kind of piles a lot of the problems onto. It's our thoughts that can really defeat us in the end.
Well, Interesting. You know, there used to be back in the 70s, the kind of root of this was my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, and Ramdas, who was, I was thinking, goodness gracious, Ramdas coined the meme, be here now, in the English language. That's a very big deal that somebody coined that.
Yeah.
Pith instruction and like actually got a close to a patent on it, you know. But they used to, at Naropa Institute, when it was just a beginning place in Boulder, one summer, Rinpoche was in one tent and Ramdas was in another tent. And then they would have occasional dialogues. And one thing that emerged, and this is, I want to launch us into your what you're saying about the divine, was this notion that Trungpa Rinpoche was very big on, which was non-theism, that Buddhism is non-theistic.
Right.
And so you probably know this, but like in the Buddhist framework, they say there's two extreme beliefs. One is theism and one is nihilism. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Well, what's in the middle? What's neither of those two is the middle way, obviously. But so from a classical Buddhist perspective, one could interpret the Hindu approach as a theistic approach. In other words, the deities are seen to be real, substantial, that they have some actual solid existence on some level of reality. And the Buddhists would say that the even though they use the deities, that they're empty. And that right. The deity and the perceiver of the deity co-arise in an interesting way. So are you a theist or a non-theist, would you say?
I definitely love God. And that's my anything. That's my stance. that's the party. And everything that I'm trying to do is hopefully bringing me a more of an awareness to be able to love God. And by loving God, I mean by loving the self and loving everything that you come into contact and being able to see that the divine in all things through undifferentiated light. Now, when you get into undifferentiated light and then you get into no right or wrong, now you're into almost a non-theistic thing, you know?
Sure.
You know, so you're into consciousness. And that, to me, that's what Shiva, the true meaning of Shiva is the consciousness of infinite goodness, you know, whether it be God, whether it be Shiva, whether it be Christ, Buddha, Allah, you know, whoever it might be. It's again, like you were talking about earlier with the tendrils and like what kind of sadhana or practice people pick up. It's true what you're saying, and it's really profound, actually, because the Zen people find Zen, the Buddhist people find Buddha, the Krishna people find Krishna, and it's perfect. It's a perfect moment. That's to me such a beautiful expression of the divine, you know, that the right people find the right places. And when you try to force it, it's impossible. It just doesn't work. You burn out instantly. Mm-hmm. So thank God.
Yeah. Well said. And of course, you know, these things can be parsed. The reason for talking about them is not to A, disparage anybody or their perspective, but it is to, you know, to maybe heighten if there are underlying assumptions, fixations about how these things are working. So, you know, but to me, it's very interesting the way Buddhism evolved as a kind of, very hardcore individual practice at first. It gravitated towards a more social interactive process, which is the Mahayana thing. And then the Buddhists, you know, clearly met up with the Mahasiddhas in India in the form of one of the great moments in the history of my lineage is Talopa, who was a kind of Mahasiddha-style crazy yogi who supposedly did not have an earthbound teacher. You know, he was directly inspired. And then he meets up with Naropa, who's a Buddhist scholar, you know, and the dance between those two people actually charges up the canon for the ongoing lineage for hundreds and hundreds of years afterward. And the outcome a little bit later on is you have tantric monasticism, which is almost an oxymoron. Right.
Well, what you just described is exactly my lineage. Our Sadhguru is a Mahasiddha. whose name is Cody Tataswami. He lived, many people say that he lived to be 300 years old in his most recent body that was on this planet. He's part of the Tamil Nadu Siddhas like Bogar or Agastir and Babaji, who's in the Kriya Yoga. And my teacher is embodied by this, the Cody Tataswami. He comes into his body and he channels him. And that's how we receive a lot of our grace through him, you know? And
Robert, have you sat there and witnessed this? What you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I've had darshan with Tataswami many times through my teacher, and even going to his samadhi in India and just being present where he is, you know. And also some of the other samadhis in South India where I've had these kind of transmissions from the Siddhas.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, it's one thing to hear about these things, another to experience them.
I think that's the only way you can really believe them. That's why I'm a little reluctant to talk about it, you know, because you said it, I needed to, I definitely needed to follow up on that, because it was like, you just explained your lineage and my lineage and how they were kind of these parallel lines, you know, maybe at different times on the planet, but they seem to be on the same ley line, you know, through these Mahasiddhas who are the perfected ones on this planet.
You're, you know, the Shiva energy is magnetizing to me personally, because when things come together, it's wonderful. When things stay together, it's wonderful. But when they come apart, there's almost the greatest opportunity to really see the true nature of them.
Wow, so, that's really well put. Yes. Yeah.
You know, because we do get attached along the way to the form that they take, right?
Yeah. And he, you know, like one of the names of Shiva is Rudra, and it's he that takes away all suffering. And sometimes by taking away that suffering, it can be very difficult for people to experience because they're clinging onto it so hard. Sure. So that they might experience suffering in the taking away of their suffering, maybe holding on to a loved one too close, or holding on to a material thing too close, or job, or whatever it might be. Any sense of identification, you know, once that's stripped from the person, they're able to really experience life in the truest, best form of themselves. But it takes a lot of letting go, you know.
You know, how does Narayana fit into that scheme of things?
Narayana, as Krishna, you know, as far as I know him as Lord Krishna, or Vishnu, Narayana and Shiva have this kind of back and forth. Shiva is always worshiping Narayana's always worshiping Shiva. Uh-huh. And it's kind of like the two sides of the same coin. And then Brahma is in the weird, there's a very strange kind of relationship with the three in the forms of worship, because there are no temples to Brahma, because there's a curse to Brahma, you know?
Oh. So what do you mean? There's a curse to embodying the form too much? Or?
No. So the story is, can I tell the story real
quick?
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. Okay. So there was a column of light that came from the ground, or it actually didn't, they didn't know where it came from. And Brahma and Vishnu are looking at this column of light. And Brahma was like, I created it. And Vishnu was like, I don't think he did, because it's been here the whole time. I'm not sure. It has, you know, they're kind of going back and forth. Well, where does it end? Where does it start? So Vishnu takes the form of Varahi, which, and digs into the ground to try to find the bottom of it. And Brahma hops on his swan and tries to find the top. And neither one can find a beginning or end. So Brahma thinks he's getting towards the top because he sees a flower falling. And he's like, oh, I must have been near the top. And he asks the flower, where's the top of this column of light? And he's like, there is no end, you know? So he's like, well, I'm going to bring you down as proof that I found the top. Uh-huh. And he goes back down. Vishnu was like, I can't find the bottom of this thing. Brahma's like, I found the top. I brought this flower down from the top of the column of light. And Shiva comes out of the calm of light and said, "You're a liar. There is no beginning or end. Light is infinite. Because you lied, no one will ever worship you in any kind of ritual or temple. And that's the curse of Brahma." And then the certain flower, I can't remember the name of the flower, but that certain flower is one of the only flowers that you will not be able to use in a puja. It's inauspicious.
Wow.
How utterly cool.
Yeah.
So Narayana, I was working on a record with Krishnadas, and I had a dream that we were in the studio working on it. And now, remember, I'm a Buddhist, so this is like, you know, more of my subconscious gossip is from the Buddhist tradition and so forth. However, I sometimes leap over or jump over into parallel tracks for a minute. So in the dream, we're in the studio, and we're working on the music, and then all this energy came into my body in the dream, and I kind of just felt completely uplifted and literally levitated up into the air, in a recording studio, mind you. And then I heard this voice, and it was, we were working on Narayana, was the we worked on a huge production with like 96 tracks of like vocals and instrumentals. We just did like you know, a really big production on it, and the chant was around Narayana, and the voice said this: "I am the one who knows who I am. I am the one who knows who I am." Didn't make any sense to me at all in the dream. I had no precedent for why I would have said that or what the meaning of it was. But, you know, these energies, we've connected with them, in, I'm sure, many, many lifetimes. And because I have this connection with these friends and these dear ones, you know, KD and Ramdas and that whole, I call them my cousins, you know, they're like first cousins. Sometimes you get, you know, some feeling of the deities. Krishna in particular obviously comes through pretty strongly, and it's so beautiful, you know, Robert, to hear you talk about this. It's really lovely. You clearly have a strong connection with it, and something's coming alive when you're talking about it. I just want to share that with you.
Oh, thank you. That's a huge compliment. And Narayana, you know, like in many of these slokas, and like probably a lot of the mantras or whatever was in that song, a lot of them end in the last lines that will say, "He who chants this daily will receive peace in the three worlds," you know, and that mm-hmm. you've received a vision of Narayana in your dreams. And that's one of the three, you know, waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the three worlds. And of course, with your practice and everything you're doing, you're going to be charging up in all three of them.
Yeah. "I am the one who knows who I am" doesn't really delineate. It undelineates subject and object, you know, that it just goes, it starts to go into a cycle, you know. So this now, you know, the spirituality is so strongly an element in who you are and what you're doing. I mean, this is, it just looks from here, if you were not like a tattoo artist, you'd be a priest of some kind. That would be my estimation of your, you know, manifestation. So it seems like you are being a priest through being a tattoo artist, which is creativity and spirituality there. Those are kind of very interwoven for you, no?
Yeah, priest and a clown too, you know, like, but you know, and I'm not trying to be flippant by saying that just a little bit, but like, there is like this kind of karma aspect to it. And I see that in a lot of the spiritual techniques, especially in like a lot of the Native American traditions, they used clown and makeup and kind of things. And like, I see that, you know, tattooing in America was kind of born out of the carnivals. And, I kind of, again, trying to use this kind of tantric approach and weaving all these things together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is, you know, the best way I can share everything I'm experiencing through my practice, you know.
Yeah. And how much of a connection are you making with the person? Do they come in for an interview first? How do you do it?
No, most of the time, I try to keep it as brief as possible in the consultation area, just because of time. And I think, you know, I kind of like let it kind of flow organically. Mm-hmm. And most of the conversation happens during the tattoo, which my average tattoo session is 2 to 3 hours. So most people like to talk while getting tattooed. I don't mind talking when tattooing. And if it's one of these deities, then that's something that we might be talking about. And it's a good opportunity. You know, some people get them, as you mentioned earlier, you know, with no connection at all to them, no cultural connection. You know, they were born in the States or whatever, and no spiritual connection or dharmic connection or sadhana practice connection. They just like the way it looks. And people have asked me before, like, do you think that's disrespectful? You know, that someone might just get this thing, you know, it might be some sort of appropriation or something. And sure. To me, no, I think it's the access. That's the access point. That might be the one thing that could change their life drastically, the way it's changed mine. You know, picture of Krishna deeply moved me. The first picture, my first interaction with a Krishna devotee, Hare Krishna, he gave me a sticker of Lord Jagannath. You know him?
Oh, yeah.
He's the smiling one, you know?
Yeah.
And the guy hit me. I was on the boardwalk here in New Jersey, like on the ocean, you know, just like all the kids, like just like out of a movie, you know, like a summer at the beach, hanging out with your friends on the boardwalk. And this guy comes up to me and he goes, "You're under arrest." And uh-huh. I thought it was a narc, you know?
Wow.
And he hands me the Jagannath sticker and he said, "For smiling." And it said it was Krishna as Jagannath, and it said smile. And I said, you know, I just stopped eating meat. I became a vegetarian, and I know that the Hare Krishnas don't eat meat. So then we started talking, and he taught me the Maha Mantra that night, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. We chanted it on the beach together, and I went to a temple a few weeks later, and then this whole thing started cascading, you know. And that was the jump off. That was my access point. You know, but it was that image, that Jagannath, that really took me. And I wrote about it a little bit in the book, but just that smiling face, the smiling face of God, you know, like, you know, he wasn't like an old man pointing his finger at you from the clouds. It's like this big, goofy kind of psychedelic clown smiling at you, you know, and that smile is reflecting the goodness in you when you really get down to it. And there's this beautiful chant I was listening this morning of when will I be in Jagannath's gaze? You know, because he has the big eyes. Like, when will he see me? You know, when I see him. You know, I know they used to use that technique at Grateful Dead shows. You're under arrest because it's disarming, you know. You're, of course, you know, you're at a dead show, probably pocket full of liquid LSD or something, and all of a sudden someone comes up to you and says, "You're under arrest." What a way to get your attention.
Well, as you may know or not know, I was at one Grateful Dead concert, only one, but I was playing at it.
Wow.
And
with Krishna Das, or?
No, this is way back. This is way before I knew Krishna Das. But I had a band with bluegrass band with Jerry Garcia and David Grisman and Taj Mahal and Richard Green. It was called the Great American Music Band. There you can find recordings of it, audio recordings of it online. The Great American String Band or Great American Music Band. And Jerry played banjo and I played guitar in it.
Wow.
Mid-70s. So we did, as that band, open a Grateful Dead concert in Santa Cruz, which was 100,000 people. It was a kind of unique experience, but it's the only time I ever was at a Grateful Dead concert. And it was the interesting thing I was thinking, I don't know if you know who David Grisman is, the mandolin player.
Yeah.
You remind me of him a little bit. That's what I was thinking about 20 minutes ago. There's something about your energy that reminds me of David. Dog is his nickname, Dog. And, you know, one of the unique and original mandolin players, you know, who took the bluegrass thing over into the kind of jazz and fusion-y area.
Amazing player. Yeah.
Amazing. And, you know, kind of that was a pretty seminal time for me. And yeah, I look back and I go, oh, wow, that was interesting. I was in a band with Jerry Garcia opening up for the Grateful Dead. And in a way, I never really meant to be there, if you know what I mean. It's like it just, I made a record with Maria Muldaur called Midnight at the Oasis, and I was floating around the West Coast. And I ended up, David Grissom was my friend from New York, and I ended up moving up there to really, I stayed at his house for a while and then found a place to live, and we started that band together. All by accident, you know, and
no accident.
Yeah.
No accident. Come on.
I'm saying it with the tongue in cheek because it's not an accident either. That's
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So,
you didn't plan to be in a band with those guys and do the thing.
Yeah. But just the way you described the onset of your spiritual journey, you know, which was, just bumping into somebody. I think this is a pretty common thread for most people. And when they ask, a lot of people ask, how do I get into something like this? In a way, it comes to you better than you go to it, if that's orchestrated. Otherwise, people maybe, you know, try some different things, you know, try going to a concert or a workshop or a training or something and see how it fits. But there's more magic usually in this area where you kind of find your... A perfect example of this for me was Trungpa Rinpoche would just connect with people. He was hailing a cab in New York City, and Allen Ginsberg was hailing the same cab, and that's how they met. That's how Allen became his student. And there's another story about Rinpoche was in Boulder with his small group of students at a cafe, and a guy just walked past the window, and Rinpoche said, just go get him, go get that guy. And they brought him in, and that guy turned out to be the Dorje Lopan or the Master of Studies for Trungpa Rinpoche's community, you know. So, and myself, I just wandered into a yoga studio in Boston when I was studying at Berkeley, and Trungpa Rinpoche was teaching a workshop there that weekend, you know. So, your connection with India is pretty strong. It sounds like you have gone to India in the mode of looking for a connection. Is that right?
Yeah, I before COVID, I had traveled there each year for 10 years. Oh. You know, I started pretty much on my own. I had met my teacher, my guru, he wasn't in a position to take any students at the time. He's young. He's actually younger than I am.
Mm-hmm. And what's his name? Can we say?
His name is, it's Rudra Abhishek. Okay. And he had mentioned me places that I should visit, but I started going there with him maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, about 6 years ago. And when we started traveling together, it was much more focused. We were doing a lot more sadhana. He knows all the places. He has the connect, you know, like he's as much as a amazing teacher, he is a great, guide, and, he knows how to travel very, very well. So, but the first few years that I went, I just went by myself and, you know, spent a lot of time in Varanasi and Vrindavan, those two places. And, I always wind up going back to Varanasi, anytime I travel there for at least a week, you know, just to see it because I'm so blown away by it.
And what's their reaction over there to your tattoos? Is there any, you know, because as you said earlier, there could be this feeling of like taking sacred imagery and putting it into a profane context. Some people would take issue with that, right?
Yeah, I would say 99% of the time it's positive, you know. And yeah, and you know, Indian folks love decoration. The best part for me with tattoos in India, there's not a pre-conceptualized version of it the way it is here. Like a certain person has a kind of tattoo, you know, a certain kind of person in America has a tattoo almost, you know, there's a lot like this kind of stereotypical biker or whatever, sailor or a criminal, you know, and that's an old fashioned thing. Now everyone has tattoos, but it's still there, you know, it's always kind of under the rug there, that, that kind of idea. In India, no judgment at all. People just love tattoos when they see them. They love them. They love getting them. It's not the same, you know, and they're also not trying to align themselves with like a subculture of tattooing either. You know, it's just like, to them, it's just another way of expressing. And like some of the coolest tattoos I saw were on old old Indian women that got them when they were like very young, and they just aged so cool. And they just, you know, it just told such a story seeing them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I would say it's been rare that I've received any kind of negative attention. And also, if you travel there, you kind of realize that attention is something there. Like if someone's staring at you, it might not be like a mean thing. You know, at mm-hmm. first for me, it was disarming. Like they just, you know, they look at you for a longer time. You know, they don't avert mm-hmm. their eyes to you. You know, they study you. And I think that's something really beautiful about the culture there. But mm-hmm. at first for me, like, you know, I was like, well, does this guy want to fight me? You know, and then also, you know, just being like a tourist and being white and having tattoos and being tall and all the things, you know, just not common. So, you know, it might attract attention, you know, and differently than someone without tattoos. But for the most part, it's been positive.
It sounds like talking about weaving, that you're weaving those trips back into your experience here in Asbury Park, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And what is your setup like? Do you have other tattoo artists working for you at this point? Have you built a cottage industry up out of this, a big industry? What's the business dimension of what you're doing?
I have two business partners, and we've all been tattooing over 25 years. I've been tattooing 25 years, my other partner 28, and the other one 32 years. And we have about seven tattooers that work for us.
Wow.
So there's 10 of us working. It's a pretty busy shop. Like it's in Asbury Park in downtown. We all have our own clientele, and then in the summertime, we get a lot of tourism too. So
What's the name of the shop?
Electric Tattoo in Asbury Park, New Jersey.
Can I just walk in there and say I want a tattoo right now?
On a Saturday.
Only on Saturday?
Saturday and Sundays we do walk-ins. If you want one from me, it would have to be Saturday. We do walk-ins when we can, but a lot of times we have appointments, especially now with the COVID schedule and stuff. We're doing more appointment work, but now we're getting back into the walk-ins.
And do people usually come in with a piece of artwork that they want, or do you provide that for them? How does that happen?
For me, I'm in a unique situation where I get to do a lot of my own artwork. So I'm commissioned to do maybe certain things, or people are picking out designs that I have pre-drawn. But many of the customers of the shop are bringing in their own stuff or just picking out stuff that we have.
Is there a website for it?
Yeah, electrictattoonj.com.
Okay, so people can go look and see
if they
can tune into how to go about this if they go to the website and tells them how to get on board.
Yeah, definitely. All the information that you need would be there.
And are you prospering?
Oh, yeah. Tattooing is it's an amazing business. You know, it's busy. Its popularity has grown exponentially since I started. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be kind of more of a seasonal thing where, you know, you'd have enough local and regular clientele to get you through the year, but the summers were slammed. Now it's all year round. It's pretty busy the whole time.
So from the point of view of creativity, spirituality, and making a buck, your livelihood and your creativity and your spirituality are pretty much in alignment to you know, it kind of makes you almost a manifester, as we describe it in the book. You know, you've aligned your expression, the great artistic expression, your spiritual practice, which is very serious to you. It's obvious to anybody that this is not just you're not just dabbling in this. And then you've created a business around it, and the business is you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it feels like it's very much in alignment with your core principles, how the business is being run. Is that true?
100%. When I was younger, I used to kind of compartmentalize those things, mm-hmm. you know, my spiritual beliefs and my work and my art. Once I opened up to loving God and trying to bring consciousness into my life, I was able to open up to all three and realize that they weren't mutually exclusive, that it was one thing. And you could balance the three of them in such a way that each one provides for the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they inform you know, it's interesting how when if there's something unhealthy about the business, it's really I talk about it like acupuncture. Like, for example, if I go to an acupuncturist and I say, my kidney, you know, there's a pain here. They put a needle in my toe. And I go, right. Well, wait, no, I'm talking about over here. This is where it hurts, you know. So that idea of like sometimes, and I talk about this in the book, that business problems are really spiritual problems in disguise. And sometimes, you know, creativity problems are really spiritual problems in disguise. You know, there's a kind of acupuncture-like diagram going on there. So, but I think this is a challenging proposition to achieve that level of integration, which is why I decided to address it. Because there has been a tendency for centuries to isolate the spiritual and temporal domains, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you talk about Hinduism in a way that is so integrated. I don't always hear that. It's like there's this whole other world here in which these deities are occupying, and it's very pure, and it does not have anything to do with your sense perceptions or your appetites in life or sexuality or food or family or anything. You know, it's over here, and you want to transcend that to get to this. And then The other approach is the materialism thing is way, way off on its own. And just that, look, shut up. The point is go out and make a lot of money and stop with this fairy tale stuff, you know. And so the idea of integrating them is just something that really attracted me from the early start of when I got into this stuff. It's like, what would the world look like in which there wasn't a spiritual temporal diaspora going on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think about the rishis a lot because they were all grihasthas. They were all householders. They were all married. They weren't monks. Mm. And these are the ones that provided us with the greatest works. You know, everything that we chant, everything that we know, every kirtan, every bhajan comes from the rishis. And, you know, they also had to live a life of a householder, you know, married and going, you know, I think, and that to me, it's the ultimate way to put your practice into practice, you know, and your through your life, you know, and live a life. You can go to a cave, but you might not ever get a chance to apply what you've learned in the cave if you don't leave.
Yeah, it is so it's very encouraging for me personally to hear you talk this way because, frankly, this perspective is not. As obvious as it might seem, it's not a common thread. And you do deal with people who are materialists, and even to the extent that their outlook about life itself is materialistic. And I mean in the literal sense that the material is what there is, you know?
Yeah.
And then you have the spiritual people who go like, well, the material thing is, you know, just a downgrade and you just don't worry about that. You pratyahara, you close off the sense gates, you become, you know, pure, you become an ascetic. And, you know, when I studied with Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, he introduced this idea of these Shambhala teachings in which really it's Rishi training. So we've created this, you know, this portal called dharmamoon.com, which Michael Kammers, our mutual friend, works with me on and a lot of people are working on. And the whole idea is one of the things we say is when the sun of Dharma shines, the moon of Dharma reflects all that brilliance in the form of culture, art, civilization, society. So that's the reflection, and that's why we call it Dharma Moon. And it's so in those teachings, the way they come down, things like art and culture are really important. Whereas in the ascetic teachings, people say, oh no, that's just distraction through the realm of the senses. So it sounds like we really, and the Rishi portal, it's just interesting. I've said before, this is Rishi training. I mean, junior Rishi training. I'm not talking about the big ones, but to learn how to master your entire world, integrate your world, have your spiritual values reflected in how your shop runs. But it's really challenging.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
Nowhere to hide.
That's the battlefield. That's the Kurukshetra of the Bhagavad Gita. It's the fight of Durga when she's killing Mahishasura. You know, the battle's always happening. That's why all the gods and all the saints and all the Buddhas, they all have their weapons and everything. It's like, you have to be vigilant. It takes effort, you know, and that I guess that's the best way I can say it is it takes a lot of effort, but those efforts reap so much reward.
Yeah. And are you a family person? Do you have your own family?
I'm married. We don't have children. But it's me, my wife, Megan, and the dogs.
Yeah. Sweet. And you live right there in Asbury Park?
I'm in Neptune, the next town over, yeah, which is even a cooler name.
Yeah. Well, so, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your world. There's such a strong feeling of heart, Robert, coming through. It's sort of unmistakable. And is there anything that you would want to, you know, let people know about? Any famous last words before we have to close up? Like any message or any, you know, thing you want to draw them towards or anything like that?
First of all, I'm honored and thank you for the kind words. And I really, this has been a great conversation. What we're doing right now is such a huge part of what a spiritual life is discussion of spiritual topics, you know, and, you know, we use this word spiritual and it's just a discussion. Any discussion is a spiritual discussion between two people, you know, if you love yourself enough to see it that way.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I'm just going to hold your book up again, Deity.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay. So, and it's Raking Light Projects. That's how you can look it up. I guess we could look for Robert Ryan on Instagram. That would be another way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Robert Ryan 323 on Instagram.
And then the website for the tattoo center again?
ElectricTattooNJ.com. All one word.
Yeah. Fantastic. And a special shout out to Michael Cameras, who's, we've decided a new title for him. It's Podkick.
That's amazing.
He's my podcast. I don't know if anybody has, I guess people have podcasts, but it was part of the entertainment environment I grew up in.
You have the first actual as a term podkick, which
really
is, wow.
Are we coining a phrase?
That's, I so think exciting. You are coining a phrase. Yeah. That's amazing.
Well, so
I'm here for it.
Yeah, good luck for everything that you're doing. I hope that we can stay friends and stay in touch.
I can't wait to meet you in person. I'm sure we will. I'm looking forward to it. We have a few mutual friends and we need to cross paths, you know?
Yeah. And when the thing calms down a little bit, Michael and I will take a drive out to your shop. Okay.
Yeah. Come visit the Jersey Shore rock and roll mecca of Asbury Park.
It's something else. So be safe, be happy, be healthy, and all the best to you.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 30 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with Robert Ryan. That one was particularly fun for me. You could say that both David and Robert have left their mark on me. That's right, folks. It's the outro monologue. It's 2 in the morning in New Jersey, and, you know, we improv a little more on the end here. There's a certain number of things that need to be said, but first and foremost, thank you to Robert for joining us. Thank you to David for teaching. Thank you to everyone at the Be Here Now Network for all their hard work to continue Ram Dass's legacy and to continue just putting out so many great discussions and teachings around Dharma. Also, if you'd like to hear more discussions with Robert, who is really great at articulating Dharma and at being a compelling conversationalist, you can check him out on the Duncan Trussell podcast. I know there are many of the friends of this podcast who are also Dunkites, as David calls him. That was where I first was exposed to Robert. Also, if you'd like to see a little more about Robert's work, there's an amazing Vice documentary entitled Tattoo Age that features Robert. If you'd like to connect with us at Dharma Moon, our global online mindfulness platform, head over to www.dharmamoon.com. We always have lots of amazing programming. If you'd like to study with David and connect with us in community, every month we have an open community sit. We have a Foundations of Mindfulness course that is also currently running. And we have a lot of great webinars on Wednesday nights. We are starting to have mindfulness and webinars. We have one on shamanism with Alberto Villoldo, who was also on this podcast. I think it was episode 18. You can just scroll down on the old Spotify. And then we also have one with Pete Holmes coming up. So, lots of great things. And I think I'm running out of steam here, so we should just call it. I thanked everybody, right? Did I thank you? I said Dharma Moon. I said go to the Be Here Now Network. All right. How precious this human incarnation is. And if we part with anything, let's just take a moment to recollect the preciousness and impermanence of it all. May you be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.